Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I am still Adam Lowther. And Curtis McGiffin is still himself.
Hello. In
Jim I'm Petrosky. Not sure who I am.
We don't know which of his many personalities has showed up this week, but
he's a regular Sybil over here.
So, you know, today we've got a great topic, and that's, of course, because President Trump has given us this topic, and I'm talking about Iron Dome for America. Which is something that the president wants to give the American people. And he signed an executive order. Curtis, you've delved into this executive order in detail. What's your take on what the president's objectives are and what he's, you know, signed, I guess, into law with this order?
Well, thank you, Adam. Good to see you. You know, this is a campaign promise fulfilled, right? President Trump campaigned on building an Iron Dome for America. And within a week of his ascendancy into the White House, on January 27th, he issued an executive order. I'm sorry, I don't have the number, but it's one of the early ones. And basically, the idea here is he's hereby ordered basically an evaluation in 60 days to stand up some sort of Iron Dome. That doesn't mean we're going to have it in 60 days, of course, right? I mean, but it's sort of to orient the country. It's kind of like Kennedy's promise that by the end of the decade, we'll go to the moon and back, right? I think it's something similar in philosophy here. But what's interesting, I kind of want to start with here, Adam, is the very first paragraph, section one, the purpose, where in the executive order, President Trump identifies the threat of attack by ballistic, hypersonic, and cruise missiles and other advanced aerial attacks remains the most catastrophic threat facing the United States, unquote. I found this particularly interesting. I'm not saying I don't disagree or agree. I'm just saying this is also in light of a massive cyber attack.
Certainly seems new.
A pandemic, fentanyl, which kills 100,000 Americans a year. None of those are the most catastrophic threat facing the United States today. It is this threat of aerial attack. And again, I'm not nitpicking with the president here. Far be it. I'm just saying that it seems it's not something we've heard over the last 8 years, right? So this is interesting that there is an effort here to sort of focus American defense policy in this. What I find very interesting, you know, we in the deterrence theory world, Adam, we call this ballistic missile defense is deterrence by denial, right? We want to deny the adversary the success of an attack, right? And so by them thinking, if I launch an attack, it'll just fail, you can deter them, you know, through this idea. It's futility. I can't bother, right? It's just not worth the attack. And they might retaliate anyway and that sort of thing. And their stuff will survive. And to the credit of this executive order, President Trump lays out here to further the goal of peace through strength. It is the policy of the United States. It is the policy of the United States, quote unquote, that the United States will provide for the common defense of its citizens and the nation by deploying and maintaining a next generation missile defense shield. The United States will deter and defend its citizens and critical infrastructure against any foreign aerial attack on the homeland, and the United States will guarantee a secure second strike capability. That's nuclear retaliation. Those are the three the policy purposes, if you will. And I think this is very noble because the language is, to me, very, is again, is very, you know, constitutional-esque, right? It is about, you know, the primary purpose of America's, the government is, right, is to defend the sovereignty and safety and security of its citizens and its territory. And this is sort of the essence of it all. It's a very Kantian strategy for those of you who are wonky in the deterrence theory world. And it really does, I think, if it were to come to fruition, would enhance assurance or our extended deterrence. Because if our allies believe that we will, in fact, engage our nuclear forces on their behalf because our entire country is protected by missile defense, that they'll really believe in our credibility that we would be there, and they would not get any of their own nuclear weapons at that point.
Well, so this is a point where sort of stopping and making sure our audience understands what you're saying.
Okay. Yep.
And it's just this. So picture, listener, that the United States has a shield that can absolutely protect the United States, the homeland, from ICBMs, from low observable cruise missiles, from hypersonic weapons, you name it. We can shoot it down.
How about balloons? I know, Chinese balloons. Would that be part of it?
Yeah, that's the low-tech solution. We already know we can't shoot them down. We've seen them. So at any rate, so we can shoot all that stuff down. Now, the question then becomes, when the Russians say, comrade, will you trade New York for Rome or Brussels or Bonn, Germany or whatever, we can say, yes, we will. Because if you shoot at us, we'll shoot it down. So that goes to your point where you're saying, yes, extended deterrence becomes much more credible.
That is,
and
correct.
So that's kind of a really sort of compelling part of this, is that additional extended deterrence credibility. All right,
that's
so
right.
I interrupted you.
I appreciate that. And I think that now there's a downside to this, depending upon,
yes,
your persuasion and in deterrence theory, and that is the shelling arguments that really base the success of deterrence on mutual vulnerability. And this was sort of the crux of our Cold War strategy, that we believe that if we remain vulnerable and allow the Soviets a free ride of their missile systems to hold us at risk, that we would know that, and if they did the same, there'd be no need to shoot each other because we know we would annihilate each other. Mutual assured destruction is born from mutual vulnerability. The problem is the Soviets never believed in that or subscribed to it, and we didn't know that until the 90s,
right,
for the most,
yeah,
part, right? And so it was just by happenstance, I think, in some cases that argument, you know, held any. But that was the whole purpose of the ABM Treaty in 1972 in the first place, right, was to ensure mutual vulnerability. And, of course, that was terminated by President George W. Bush 43 in 2002 because of this supposed rogue threat from North Korea. But we're talking about something that's much bigger now, right? So not only in capability, but certainly in cost, right? So this is the other downside of this whole,
yes,
thing, is the cost of what,
yes,
this might be.
Yes, yes.
In the world of nuclear weapons, Adam, offense is always cheaper than defense.
Well, so you bring this up now. There was a recent contract let for some new, you know, ground-based interceptors or,
right,
you know, part of the, you know, our missile defense capability. And so what, I think you
right,
have the cost, don't you?
Yeah,
what was
I do.
The cost
so
of that?
I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the contractor, and if I did, it'd probably be inappropriate for me to say. But is it public that the Next Generation Interceptor, or the NGI, just in early 2024, a contract was let for $17.7 billion. Now, to be fair, $13 billion of that $17 is for the development, right? And then the rest of it is for the construction, the deployment, and the maintenance of 21 missiles. When we dollar cost average that first contract over 21 missiles, interceptors, that's $842 million per unit. Now, I would point out, Adam, that the Sentinel ICBM, even after the Nunn-McCurdy breach, is supposed to be costed out at about $162 million per unit. So roughly a quarter of the cost of one NGI would be the cost of offense in the Sentinel. And so if you subscribe to the mutual vulnerability paradigm, which I would discount would even exist today, but for the most part, it is much offense is much cheaper by about 75%.
Well, now let's be fair, and you know that's 21, 14 upfront design costs,
yep.
engineering costs, and then so basically it's 3 for the build out. Now let's suppose instead of doing 21, we do 100. I mean, really, if we want to field this kind of a system, we're probably going to need somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 at a minimum.
Yes, that's the point, right? So if yeah. you assume it's a one-for-one hit, that every interceptor hits, right? Every interceptor takes off, every interceptor tracks, every interceptor finds a target, and then actually detonates and shoots, quote-unquote, a missile or an RV down. And many of the Russian missiles are MIRVed, so you really got to target each RV. You're talking maybe a 5-to-1 ratio, and that's if everyone works, right?
Yeah, and on top of that, you know, the Russians, I mean, the enemy always gets a vote. So when if we start fielding, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 of these, the Russians are going to go, well, you're trying to negate our deterrent.
That's right.
So we're just going to build more of them. And right. so therefore we got to build more. So therefore for those who do not, and oh, by the way, the Russians have already said, if you build Iron Dome for America, we're going to, you know, build a massive nuclear arsenal to counter your Iron Dome for America.
Well, that's right, Adam. In January 30th, Newsweek published an article from quoting a Russian foreign minister, Grigory Mashkov, who said that they would have to expand and upgrade their nuclear arsenal to answer any development of a missile defense system in the United States.
So the question then is it, you know, there used to be a time where we could spin the Russians into the ground, right? They accused of this during the Cold War. They thought we were trying to bankrupt them. And in many respects, we actually were yep. trying to bankrupt mm-hmm. them, and we could, right? Their economy was, right. yeah. But now, but when you have the Russians, the North Koreans, the Chinese.
Well, we didn't have a $36 trillion debt in the Cold War time frame, and we didn't trade with our adversary. We traded a tiny, tiny amount of GDP with the Soviet Union. You know,
we kept them from starving every year
to keep from starving. Mm-hmm. I think we have like a 35-40% trade ratio with the Chinese. I mean, it's just a totally different scenario. Purchase power parity allows them to build systems a lot cheaper than we can, so this is a challenge that we have to think about economically.
So then this leads me to the sort of the Jim question, which is, Jim, if you're, you know, you're a technical guy, and if you were to be a betting man and an engineer, which any good engineer knows, don't be a betting man, but let's suppose you were.
Engineers don't play the odds, right?
They don't. They don't. So you're an engineer and a betting man.
In this realistic world you're talking about.
Yes, exactly.
Are you going to place your bets on building Iron Dome for America? Are you going to try to – would you build other defensive capabilities? You know, let's say bomb shelters in every neighborhood in America? Because remember, if we're going to talk about Kahn, Herman Kahn wanted robust defenses. He wanted bombs, and we used to have far more bomb shelters. They were widespread. They're not anymore. You know, so do we build bomb shelters, defenses, the kinds of stuff that Kahn talked about? Or do we build, you know, more offensive capabilities, both numbers and variety? Because that's, you know, we've got our modernization program is build new stuff that's the same as what we've always had, but just new versions. But do we build new and different? Or do we build more robust cyber capabilities? Or, you know, what if you're going to bet on what is the best approach? Thinking, you know, take a technical lens on it as far as, you know, cost, you know, probability of success, you know, offense. It does matter technically because we know what GBIs and what their probability of kill is. We understand how effective bomb shelters can or cannot be. We understand offensive capabilities. So we sort of know how well they work. So asking you, Jim, where do you place your bets on this?
No, that's my answer. I mean, what a question. This is like, tell me the entire history of the American or the human race, and don't talk about, you know, anything that's beyond simple high school math or something. I mean, come on. This is a complex problem. So first of all, and of course you were trying to lead the listener, but I'm not going to fall for that either. So the answer, you're asking a technical question. Can we build this? Sure. We can build anything. We're engineers. You tell us what you want, we'll build it for you. Get out of the way and we'll do it. Okay. That's my answer from an engineering standpoint, because we know that we can build the Iron Dome. Let me go backward, though. I'm going to go backward a lot further. So I'm going to start out with Curtis's premise on this. He said that, you know, the purpose of this, and the reason why I bring this up is your question is all about what is the purpose? What are we purposefully building something? You know, what is the mission that we are trying to extract in building this Iron Dome in this executive order? And Curtis points out very, very upfront, you know, the threat of ballistic, hypersonic, cruise missiles, and other advanced aerial attacks remains most catastrophic threat facing the United States. And unlike Curtis, I'm going to be bold and saying, I'm not sure it is. Okay, President Trump, I don't think it is. I really don't. So you want an opinion? I got one. Fire me. And especially when you go down below, two paragraphs later, it says over the past 40 years, rather than lessening the threat from next generation strategic weapons, has become more intense and complex with the development of peer and near peer adversaries of next generation delivery systems. So now we're talking about strategic weapons. To me, that's, you know, code word for nuclear weapons. Okay. And next generation delivery systems, their delivery systems, and their own homeland integrated air and missile defense capabilities. My point here is, I think I read into this, and this is unfortunate because I really don't like the way this is written, and it doesn't spell out to me the missile, the true mission here, because I think there's a vulnerability that I believe, maybe I'm wrong, and the Trump administration call me and tell me I'm wrong, and then we'll move on, is that the vulnerability they're trying to get rid of here is all that precursor action that opens the doors to a vulnerability. You take out our eyes and ears. You take out our power. You take out our communications. You take out all these things that can be done with non-strategic weapons, so our strategic vulnerability becomes big. Okay? Think about it. You take out power. You take out people. You take out all these things. Now the U.S. becomes quite vulnerable. And, you know, we left out my favorite, and everyone that reads my bio knows that EMP's big. You take out, you do an EMP, but, you know, with a nuclear weapon, and voila, we open vulnerabilities within the United States of an attack, because communication, transportation, banking, government, you fill in all the blanks of all those systems. So when you talk about building an anti-ballistic missile, an Iron Dome over the United States, I see that is what this is written to, but I'm not really clear on it because, as Curtis said, we're not really sure what this is all about. So going back to Adam's 25-minute rant question, trying to lead me to say, oh, we should build offensive capabilities versus defensive capabilities. My answer still is, what are we using this Iron Dome to prevent? What is the prevention of something out there that we are attempting to do with this Iron Dome? We are not Israel. We are not sitting in the middle of a very, very nasty neighborhood that's been threatening us for years. surrounded by our adversaries who are ready to attack us. I don't think Canada and Mexico and the Bahamas, that I mentioned in the last podcast, by the way, are out there ready to pounce on the United States in an attack. Israel is in that kind of a location. So I think the Iron Dome means a lot more for them than it does for us. Now, that said, what do we need to prevent? Well, what we need to prevent in a defense that will make deterrence more capable is deterring our adversaries from thinking they can take us down, whether it be stronger electrical grid, more well-rehearsed and advanced response to nuclear attack, which may include bunkers. And if you are on the video, which I would suggest you do, look behind me. I always keep my civil defense detector sitting back here, which everyone used to have in their homes, because we used to say, if you attacked us, we're prepared. The other side, whichever side it is, I can't. Yeah, well, one of these back here. Okay, but my point is, you know, do we teach survivability in our schools? Do we teach duck and cover, which although you laugh about it, it's truly a smart thing to do. Do we do all that as a nation? And the answer is no, we don't. And to me, that's the cheaper defense, and that's the cheaper messaging to the adversary, Russia, to say we're preparing for an attack because we will defend it, and then you'll be attacked afterwards if we don't take the first shot. So that's a short answer. But from a technical standpoint, Adam, we can build whatever. All of these issues technically are always not the issue. The issue is, do we want to do it? Do we have the money to do it? Do we have the will to do it? Do we have the ability to take some of the shackles we put on our engineers and our scientists and our industry and our military to do these things? Are we willing to do that? And I believe that's what our adversaries are attacking. They're attacking that will. And that's the bigger problem. There.
Well, let me add to this real quick, Adam, you know, the Iron Dome, of course, is borrowed from the Israeli Iron Dome,
which we help build, by the way.
Subsidized by the American population, for sure. You know, I find that missile defense or Iron Dome kind of strategies are a lot like national health care. You know, it works for, you know, small, wealthy countries that have some subsidy from the United States, but not necessarily for a big indebted country like the United States itself. And so I'm not so sure about this, but I'll tell you a couple thoughts that I had. Jim brought up something interesting. An Iron Dome commitment such as this executive order and President Trump's vision would require a culture change that is not unlike what we experienced in the duck and cover 50s, yes, where the American people were totally aware of the Red Menace, right? They were building bomb shelters in their backyards. They were doing duck and cover in the schools. They understood where their civil defense was. And some of them had roles, you know, they had, you know, leadership roles in the block neighborhood and these sorts of things. And so it was a really large cultural commitment that we don't have in this country and would need to foster, I think, to go along with this kind of thing, especially if we're going to see interceptors, you know, based in farms, much like we saw the old Nike Ajax of the Safeguard system of the 60s, which are now cool relics to go and geo hunt on your, you know, on a Saturday afternoon. Also, I would suggest this, you know, Adam, you and I wrote Dynamic Parity last summer, and where we talked about how we would match the nuclear capabilities of our adversaries. Maybe we need a dynamic parity in missile defense. Maybe we would match what they have and utilize that mechanism to ensure that they don't have more than we do, as we look at how we would measure some limited amounts of vulnerability or some versus limited amounts of missile defense. Because let's not forget, the Russians have a very good missile defense system. The Noble system is nuclear armed and is so good, as it's reported, that it will even take out LEO satellites. So my guess is that they would try to match us by expanding that capability. You know, is this Iron Dome system prepared to be nuclear armed? Are we going to go there? Because that's what the Russians do. And that's on purpose. So they don't have to have as many interceptors. The idea of nuclear fratricide and all that sort of thing. So I think there's a couple of things to think about. There's also a lot of dependency on space-based sensors, which I think is way too vulnerable in this day and age. We need to figure out other ways to have sensors that aren't space-based, including communication systems and ways to ensure the command and control of not only our nuclear deterrent but this missile defense deterrent. And that's what this missile defense is. It's a deterrent. We don't want to ever use it. It's an insurance policy. And so we have to think about it much of the same way. It's just how it's executed, or the mindset, right, of offense versus defense is different. But the reality is they're both deterrent systems that have to be interconnected under the control of certain command and control leaders, decision makers, and these sorts of things. And you got to come to the hard decision of, are some of these sensors systems going to be nuclear armed?
So is this, is Iron Dome for America, SDI, 30 years later? I mean, is that really what we're talking about? Because it's, in many respects, if you go back to what Reagan wanted to eliminate all nuclear weapons, and he tried to negotiate with the Soviets, hey, we will protect you. These will be, defensive systems, defensive capability, and we'll protect everyone. And therefore, mm-hmm. we can all get rid of our nukes. So is this, President Trump, ultimately, in his Davos speech, he had, a short discussion where he said, I'm going to negotiate with Vladimir Putin, and we're going to, about nuclear disarmament. And so is this part of a larger discussion that perhaps President Trump wants to have? Because, the longer we see President Trump and the more we sort of understand him, the more we understand that he has a tendency to go as far as he can on an issue to then, negotiate to an acceptable place. And so my question is this sort of Iron Dome for America disarmament? Are these sort of negotiating tactics to get, where he wants to be? Or are these things where he's, really wants to get exactly what he's laid out? Because I don't know the answer to that one.
So Adam, I'll answer first. Yes. Okay. Another one of these like quadruple, double questions. But no, I think this, my opinion, and Curtis might be different, but my opinion is this SDI-esque in that it's designed to push a button for the Russians to cause them to either spend money or negotiate back. And I don't see a whole lot more than that. We certainly can do this, as I said before. But will we do it? I think, there's going to be, no matter what happens in the study, it's going to be valuable. For example, let's say we do a missile defense review and we find out that there's new technologies that can be incorporated to make Iron Dome better. Well, hey, Israel, here, some new technology, okay? But I don't see this as being what it's set out to be for exactly for one of the reasons of the multiple part question you ask, that President Trump is basically negotiating out far, so he has a negotiation point. And if the Russians want to bite, well, they can spend themselves into oblivion trying to keep up. We're Americans. We can always keep ahead. That's my opinion, Curtis.
So here are my thoughts on this. I would say that, SDI, going to the SDI question. So in last week's podcast, we talked about peace through strength, another Reagan-esque motto that President Trump has embraced. So I suppose philosophically this might be similar, but I don't really think it's the same thing. SDI was generally, I think, viewed by the Russians as just too much power in one country's hands, so to speak, right? That's why as much trust and relationship there was between Gorbachev and Reagan, there wasn't that much. And, you know, and what's ironic is Gorbachev offered to treaty away ICBMs if we would just stop doing SDI. And President Reagan refused because his vision was SDI was bigger than just the ICBMs of America and the Soviet Union, that there would be others who would get ICBMs and we would need to defend against them too.
Right.
But I think what might have been short-sighted was that was true with as far as China goes, but the reality was that it was, you know, the Russians who were still developing massive amounts of ICBMs, and that was the plan. That was Gorbachev's plan to defeat SDI, was to just overwhelm it by building more and more missiles, and I suspect that will be their plan to overwhelm this Iron Dome. They'll attempt to overwhelm it by building more and more missiles. So this argument about whether or not this is going to create an arms race, I guess, you know, those who want to argue arms races are bad will say this is going to be a bad arms race. And so that would be that's a fun academic argument to have at another time. I also would argue to your question, Adam, this is potentially, and again, we talked about this last week, leverage for the president and from which to begin to negotiate, right? Yeah. SDI was one of the main things that brought the Soviet Union down. They just could not figure out how they were going to afford to defeat SDI. And I'm thinking there's a similar argument here, right? That an Iron Dome that could happen that is so big and so overwhelming that they would not be able to afford to keep up with it. You know, the truth would be in history and also in the future. So it's hard to know. All we can do is speculate. Finally, this is another reason why we want Greenland. Because I suspect a lot of these interceptors and the sensors that would support them would need to sit on that beautiful island. And we want to make sure that if we have to put nukes there on these things, that we can. And we don't want the Danes arguing against that. And so this is going to be a challenge. And that might be why Greenland is on the target list, so
and
to speak,
politically. Well, I can only imagine how many radars and interceptor sites we're going to have in our 51st state.
Oh yes.
That's another great. Yeah, that, you know, the state of Canada will
have. Let's not freak the Canadians out any more than they already are. So.
I mean, I saw a picture in which all of the American bourbon had been removed from a Canadian liquor store. And you talk about a shocking image right there. So
after all we did for them, they still booed the American anthem at a recent hockey game. You know, these things will work themselves out. But I would say that this is
it's always a great discussion.
It's a great discussion. And to Jim's point, we are going to learn a ton of science and engineering that will be the offshoot of this stuff. And that will be good. It will probably show up in our automobiles at some point.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. You know, that happens to us every day, every podcast. And so I want to thanks, Curtis. It was a great discussion. Thanks to Jim. His irrational optimism is always is always glad. It just proves that we social scientists are the true scientists because we do think rationally. So thanks. Thanks to Jim. Of course,
making decisions based on opinion is not really a good idea.
Of course, thanks to you, the listeners. We wouldn't be here if it weren't for you. Hopefully, if you don't find it informative, perhaps you find it entertaining, because we always try to do a little bit of both. And of course, we want to remind you there's a great HUSI event that'll be coming up. Look on the website for that. There's new articles Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday of every week at Global Security Review. And then we repost articles we've read and liked. We do that just about every day at Global Security Review. And then, of course, the Twitter. Curtis is always up on the Twitter. Posting
I think
new
Elon
stuff.
Calls that the X.
Oh, the X. Sorry, the X. And he's doing that. He's Xing all the time. And so
Twixing, I think they call it. I'm not
Twixing.
Sure.
Okay. So there's always, you know, informational stuff. There's old podcasts. There's, oh, we've Deterrence Down Under. They have their own logo now. Go check out their new logo as a podcast.
As part of our podcasting network.
That's right.
Yeah. Real Space Strategies is doing some live live podcasting. So that's something else you can, you know, look forward to. There's always something. Curtis and I and Jim and some of our other colleagues are trying to put the finishing touches on an upcoming book. So there's lots and lots going on. So stay engaged. And, of course, as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.